What's your writing process? Do you sometimes have periods when you need to unlock your creativity? Well, today we have a visit from Craig Kidner from Ghosts on Vacay, and it could just be that what he's going to say and what his website can offer you will help you become a better writer. Do let us know what you think. Hello, my name is Patricia, and this is the Poetry P podcast. As I said, today we have a visit from Craig Kidner, and I think what he has to offer you will be useful whether you write haiku, any other form of poetry, or even prose. And there is a video of this conversation available in Poetry P on our YouTube channel. If you nip over there, why not subscribe? It's free. And you can write some haiku and senryu for the video prompt. You can leave as many poems as you like in the comments section for Linda, our prompt editor, to read. And you may get featured on another podcast and in the Poetry P Journal. Speaking of which, many of you contributed to the creation of the latest one. And I'm happy to tell you that it's available now, and the link is just one of the many reasons you should nip over and have a look at the show notes on Poetry P. And while you're at the website, perhaps you can check in on the submissions calendar, see what we're reading at the moment. If you're in real time, March 2024, then we're accepting submissions of Turiya Vaza haiku until the 15th of March, and then from the 16th to the end of the month, you should be sending us haibun. What fun! Our merry band of members is growing. But if you're not one of them, would you think of sponsoring the podcast and keep it going? Join up. There are a variety of memberships to choose from, and you can always buy the podcast a coffee. Details in the show notes. Thank you very much. Lastly, and really not least, are you on the mailing list? Because I'm going to be sending out some very, very exciting news soon. Something for you poets to take part in. But it will only be for those of you on the mailing list. So don't miss out. Do sign up. Okay, that's enough about me. Come along into P Towers and join Craig and I for a chat. And when we've finished, don't forget to go over to his website, have a look at what he's offering, try it, and let Craig know what you think. Hope you enjoy it. I did. Craig and I met up at Haiku North America, the conference last year in Cincinnati, and he told me about a new project he was working on, Ghosts on Vacay. Now, Craig, you might well pronounce your name differently, I know, and you may well pronounce this differently, but you'll get a chance to tell us in a second. But either way, we both thought this would be an interesting topic for a podcast. And so it's taken us a while, which is mostly my fault, but he's here at last, and we're going to hear about Ghosts on Vacay. And I'm going to put Craig's website on the show notes if you want to check it out later. And I suggest that you should, because it's very interesting. So a huge Poetry P welcome to a fellow Harry Potter fan, Craig Kidner.
Thank you, Patricia. I have always loved the way you say my name. And I figure since my name, the source of it, I believe, is possibly Scottish, maybe okay. English, I'm not sure. But I always felt the way you say my name sounds right to me. So I appreciate it.
I always feel that Craig should be a Scottish name somehow.
Hmm. Yeah. Dweller of the Crag is what I figured out. The original.
I think you could be right there.
Which works well for a haiku poet.
More of that later.
Yes.
Sorry, I interrupted you. You were going to say something about fine. North America.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to point out that so last summer for me, that was, I hit a lot of milestones last summer. And that's kind of where all this came from. Last summer I hit about 30 years of the act of creating things and putting it in front of people and working with creative communities. I hit 10 years at my current job where I'm a customer service manager and I lead a team. And, that's all about training people on how to speak, what to speak about. Mm-hmm. And it hit my seventh year of writing haiku officially. But you know, my journey through the world of creation actually began with painting and drawing. And I spent several years in Washington, D.C., exhibiting in galleries and running galleries and teaching artists. But when we moved to Wilmington, North Carolina in 2012, soon after that, the artwork went away. Can't say exactly why, but writing became much more important to me all of a sudden. And so then I began writing haiku in 2016. And the reason why I started with the haiku is it filled a need that I used to fill with sketching. And the need was just to observe and then lose myself in the observation. And that's what I was kind of missing from that visual. And that's what haiku started to give me back. Now, at the time, I didn't even realize that Shiki had the whole, you know, idea of a haiku sketch, you know, or the approach of haiku like sketching. But, you know, as the conference approached, I realized I wanted to offer something to my community that that was new and different, and something that would incorporate, you know, the experience I gathered. Most of my education in the arts has been self-education. And my education in haiku has been a lot of self-exploration and education. So guided by Basho, you know, I asked myself, how could I present an approach that would cut through the complexities that Western style education often puts in front of things? And something that would foster a mindset that I think is really crucial to the gathering and writing of authentic haiku. And when I say authentic haiku, I mean something that's authentic to the experience that inspired it. So that's where the framework of Ghost on Vacay started to come together. And I wanted an approach that would work equally well, regardless of your experience with haiku. If you've never written a haiku before, it would work. If you're a deeply experienced haiku writer, then it helped generate beginner's mind in you and can be a very useful thing to, if complexities of, you know, come into your head and are blocking you, or you just want a new way to go about it. So with that, then, with Ghost on Vacay, I came up with the concept of these haiku creation kits. And the haiku creation kit idea is that you can go out to write a haiku and you can turn your brain off completely. You don't have to think about it. You can just follow the steps I lay it out to guide you to this experience, and then let the experience take over and get to the end point of having something written down. And there was a certain spirit that drove this, and I want to kind of lay out what that was. There's something that's not a thing, but it's always present. And it has no substance, but it's the source of everything that does. And we tend to be unaware of it or attempt to capture it in concepts, but no words are capable of putting it in a box. When your mind is clear and your perception's open, you can experience it directly through what's happening around and through you. Haiku is full of it, but that's nothing special. Everything is. What is special is that haiku can convey it directly. Haiku is free of demands for commentary and interpretations. Haiku is just as it is. So to experience haiku is to enter a state that's open and perceptive, a quiet mind that can hear. And there are practical everyday steps you can take to encourage this mind within yourself through the practice of a haiku. And when your intention is focused on these steps, it's relatively easy to quiet your thoughts. Your indoctrination, your doubts, and everything that haunts your head can go away, and it makes writing haiku a much more, but those things make writing haiku a much more complicated thing than it needs to be. So in other words, you can send your ghosts on vacation while you get on with the business of experiencing your world through the natural unfolding of life. And that is the essence of what sustains haiku. As I said, the first fruits of that effort were the haiku creation kits. And three of those are going to be currently available on Ghost on Vacay as PDFs that you can download for free and experience this. And I certainly would love get feedback from that from anybody who would like to. And the goal behind all of this is to step beyond conceptualizing, get past the conceptualizing of things like go to the pine to learn from the pine, or, you know, to walk in the steps of the ancient masters. The goal, again, to get past that as a concept and to just do it. And so the kits, again, started this approach, and the approach now is currently taking the form of a field guide that I'm working on and will be publishing this year. And this was, I actually got a artist support grant from the North Carolina Council on the Arts.
Ooh.
To help develop this. And the guide is going to gather in all these things that I feel are conducive to the flowering of the haiku mind, which in a haiku mindset, it's an illuminating thing. It's unshackled. And I quite frankly think it's something that's very much needed in the world. And that is where I'm at.
Okay. So now we know where the title Ghost on Vacay came from.
Yes.
I heard you, well, we spoke about it at the Haiku North America conference, but it was very interesting to hear you work through the process on a different podcast. How dare you? You were on, let me see, what was it?
The Fox and the Fox Hound.
Yeah, which is how I know you're a fellow Harry Potter fan. And you worked through the process there. And so I would say to people, if they want to have a sort of work through it with you before they go to your kits, or, you know, if they want to work through it with the kit in hand, that was quite a handy podcast to listen to listen to a virgin haiku writer.
Yes.
put haiku together with the help of one of your kits. That was really very interesting. And I wrote to you and said, I've been thinking about apples ever since. I haven't been able to get that out of my mind. Anyway,
yes.
So I thought, obviously, I don't want you to go through all that with me. It would be somewhat terrifying, to be honest with you. But can you talk through your process, that maybe the process that you go through with the kits? And I'm guessing it comes from what you've learned over the 7 years, as you said, how you wish someone had this kit available for you when you were starting out, maybe.
Yeah. Well, process. It's an interesting question, because about halfway through my haiku writing time, so let's say about 3.5 years ago or so, I came across a concept, and quite frankly, I don't even remember where I got it, but the idea of to make writing your practice, mm-hmm. and practice in the Buddhist sense of meditative self-observation. And that kind of changed things for me a little bit. And I spent that time kind of coming to terms with that. Mm-hmm. And so for myself, the kind of base of this is foraging for haiku, which is a term I borrowed from Alan Summers. You know, the basic concept of a ginkgo walk, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I believe I'm using the right term there.
Yes, actually, maybe one the term is right, but perhaps before we go on, we should explain to the uninitiated what you mean about that.
Yes. So now this is often done as a group activity, mm-hmm. often around an event, say like the conference, where you go out just specifically for the purpose of walking around, seeing what's there, and drawing haiku from the immediate surroundings or what you're in. So for me, the foraging idea is you go to a place where you want to gather or forage for haiku. You spend some time before doing anything else just centering yourself there and just, you know, feeling what's all around you. And then in a process that's similar to meditation, you consciously bring your attention to what's going on around you. And then when thoughts occur, which they're going to, and you can, but trying to just stop thought is a really difficult thing. And I don't suggest it, but what you can do is when a thought appears, as you're doing this, you look at the thought, just like you look at say, a bird singing or a squirrel running across the branch or a cloud covering up the sun. It's just an event like any other. And you can note it just like you would an event going on around you and bring your attention back to what's going around or going on around you. Now, some of those thoughts might actually end up being in your haiku, but they're going to be in there not as, again, interpretation or parroting something that some idea or feeling that somebody else has done. They're going to be simply your observation of what passed through your head as you did the gathering. So I do this on a regular basis. And then it becomes practice for other times, say when I'm driving to work or I'm walking across the room to go get a cup of coffee. I can, because I practice with this, I can at any time turn that on and then get nice surprise haiku that, you know, that I didn't know. And plus it just has the extra benefit of being a great way to just experience your life and your life, your individual life, not the group life that's going on all around you. So I would say that, yes, that's my process. I have dedicated time out to just gather whatever's there and then be ready to turn it on when I need it. And then the process later is revision when it's time to, you know, to be quiet and to think about getting the what I've gathered up out into the world and prepare it for, you know, submission. Okay.
You've made a couple of points there that I wanted to come back on. I think you said this in your foraging, you note down your thoughts, your interpretation of what you're seeing, and then you come back and and do the writing and revision process. When you say interpretation, it brings me sort of onto the question of haiku form. Interpretation is a word that may be a little bit dangerous, because my way of thinking, and you, as I said, you may disagree with me, is that we don't necessarily interpret. We are much more objective in a haiku. So we're putting down things that actually would happen, maybe in a weird and wonderful way, but people will always be able to say, okay, that I can see the reality in that haiku. Is that what you mean, that, you know, you're looking at something, you're going to write that down in your haiku, it's going to be objective, but it might not, it might, you know, you might twist the words around slightly, you might have a slightly different take on it, a different spin, but ultimately it will be quite an objective interpretation of what you've seen.
When I use the term interpretation, what I'm really getting at is, again, the experience that led to that was the source of the haiku. Or that it, you know, forms the basis of, this is the subject. This is what I'm writing about, is okay. This experience. Again, that's a wordless experience. That's an experience that takes place up here. And if we're not careful, it gets all bound up and tied into, again, what we've learned already, what we bring to it. And this kind of is kind of the key thing. When anytime we're in the environment and we're trying to gather up haiku experiences, we're bringing to it already, we have our personality, our experience. One haiku writing book that I read said, talked about a funded experience. Okay.
Okay.
And that is really going to impact what, out of thousands of things that are going on around you and the thousands of haiku that are there to be written, you're going to be drawn to the thing that has a connection for you. Mm-hmm. And because of that, there's an authenticity there. Mm-hmm. There's an authenticity because this event is going on. This event that's going on is, I'm seeing a snapshot of it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if I see a bird on the branch and I want to write about that bird, well, that bird's life is going on well before I ever get there and will continue to going on after I'm gone, I am peeking in on a, you know, an unfolding event. Mm-hmm. But I'm drawn to it because there's something there that catches my attention. So the interpretation part really is, how do I take that event that has authenticity because I was drawn to it and not add on to it a bunch of other stuff that again, I already know. And this is all about learning, like I said, learning from the pines and walking the steps. Mm-hmm. So anything I add to that is just really kind of confusing the issue. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So then I have something that has meaning to me, but I don't interpret it. I don't, you know, and I don't add to it. I just simply pretty much record it, interpret it from mm-hmm. a wordless experience into words. And then those words will go out, and someone reading the haiku, if they have, again, the same kind of approach to reading as we do to writing, they will have a meaning of it because of their own founded experience. And maybe their meaning is the same as the one that drew me, but maybe it's different. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter. Yeah. Because again, it's all about turning back to the unfolding of life to just make us aware of that we're part of this whole thing. And you know, we can be a voice for something larger than ourselves by simply having the experience and recording it.
I don't think we're going to disagree on that one, actually. I'm happy about that. Thank you. What I was worried about was a haiku that has maybe philosophical points in it rather than, I mean, most people write fragment phrase. I'm not completely hung up on fragment phrase, but when people are writing that, sometimes there will be a fragment or a phrase that has one solid objective object in it, followed by a thought process, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you feel about that. I don't think it has a place in the haiku we write today, although it appears that more and more people are writing haiku like that. Mm. What would you call that? Post-postmodern, maybe? I don't know, but
it's interesting to say philosophy mm-hmm. and bring that in, because to a certain degree, there's no getting away from at least the perception of some kind of philosophical statement being made by a piece of poetry. It's so ingrained into the culture. You know, it's funny. I think about an old blues traveler's song, The Hook. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but The Hook is this song that's all about, I'm not singing about anything, but you think I've got some vast wisdom to give to you because you're listening to my words, right? And so you really can't get away from that. But this is what I was saying about you. You said, I have this thing and then I add thought to it. Yes, mm-hmm. That's exactly the point I'm getting at. If you're adding thought to it, then you're probably on the path of not really writing a haiku. You know, maybe you should convert that. Now, and that's the thing. If you focus on the experience first and you focus on with veracity, capturing that experience for yourself in whatever words you're doing, then the words become tools that you can arrange, rearrange, adjust, cut, and make it sure that what you're expressing there is in keeping with the idea you had for haiku in the first, or whatever, you know, perception of haiku that you have. Mm-hmm. So let me give a thought on this. So for instance, like there's a journal, Whiptail Journal,
oh, yeah,
that is dedicated to the single line of poetry and haiku and other forms as well. With the kits and with the guide, in terms of the instructions to write, mm-hmm. I do keep it in those a three line haiku. Yeah. Okay. Three line free, you know, I do suggest to use a phrase and fragment because it's a good way to get started. Mm. But from that three, you know, after that process, then you have a three line haiku to work with, or perhaps it's a haiku, you know, work with it and see. But from that, then you have you can revise it anyway. So, you know, for instance, you know, with Whiptail, I'll often have several haiku prepared in three lines, and then, okay, well, Whiptail's deadline's coming up. I want to submit to that. Can I convert this three line haiku into a single line haiku? And then I am involved in the mental process, you know, of breaking down haiku rules, guidelines, whatever, to get me something that is publishable.
Yeah.
But you're going to write a lot of haiku that never are going to see publication.
Yes, this is
true. And that's great. That's fine. They can inform and teach you and take you further along your own path. But again, it all goes back to that experience first thing. And I think that I'm informed in this because of how I learned to draw. I struggle with drawing, as everybody I think does once you hit, you know, adolescence and you realize, oh, there's people have ideas of what a drawing should look like and things like that. And one of the biggest helpful things I came across in my learning to draw was that the brain will, if you're trying to draw, say, a face, the brain will get in your way because the brain will go, okay, well, I know what a nose looks like. Let me draw a nose. And I know what this eye looks like. Let me draw an eye. And if you've named it and you're trying to draw it, you're not going to get it. You're going to end up with something that looks unnatural because you're not actually drawing that person's face. You're drawing your idea of that person's face. Very similar to haiku. I can go into haiku and I can have an experience and I can write not about the experience, not about what I saw, felt, heard, thought, but about my interpretation of all that. You know, a pine tree means something to me personally. But if I get caught up in that too much, I'm not going to write an authentic haiku. I'm going to write a poem about a pine tree.
Yeah.
And speaking of the Harry Potter podcast that I did, which, by the way, you can listen to if you go to ghostonvacay.com, right on the landing page, there's a link to that podcast. But in that, Amanda, who was the co-host, who, as you said, was the haiku virgin, she said something that I thought was very to the point here. When we were talking about the Genesis kit, that was the first kit that I did.
Yeah.
And it's all about having an experience with an apple, right? And I, you know, and she was unfamiliar with it when we did the podcast. So she wanted to go in fresh. So I read through that haiku kit and how it works. And her words were something along the lines of, well, that's interesting because if you had sat me down and said, write a poem about an apple, the first thing I would do is think about every experience I've had with an apple in the past. You know, think about apple pie. I think about fall. I think about blah, 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 all those things that the concept of apple hold. But you're telling me don't do that. You're telling me take this one apple, take it somewhere, have an experience with it, and write that. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, part of it. And that's why I chose an apple for the first one too. It's such a universal symbol in a way. And, you know, there's cultural things you can't get away with, can't get away from, right? Yeah, even the apple and all that. But an apple is only an apple, or it's always an apple. And so having a real experience with an apple might be something different than you think it is.
Yeah. Certainly was for me. I took your advice. I went and bought my apple and I sat and I held it and felt it and peeled it because I don't eat skin and so on. I still haven't written anything particularly good, but I could really see where you were coming from with the process in order to do that. It was
That's interesting you say that, Patricia, because I think one thing and there are mental disciplines, obviously. If you're going to write haiku, you gotta rein this thing in a little bit. The concept of did I write a haiku can be, or good, did I write a good haiku can be a dangerous concept. It's something that, again, kind of drawing from visual art world, but I had read a book years and years ago that was, the essence of the book is, why do so many people who go and get a master's of fine arts degree end up stop making art? And he delved into quite a few things. One of the things he said is you have to create a bunch of bad art to have good art. You're going to have to write a bunch of bad haiku to have good haiku, or at least if you're trying to take the haiku further down the road for yourself. And not just, again, write haiku that is recognizable as haiku, might be very fine haiku, but might not be really true to you. And you might miss some new thing that haiku can embrace.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, when I think of it, a bad haiku was probably the wrong way of putting it. I mean, yes, they weren't particularly good, but they didn't yet have my voice or the way I wanted to write them yet. So, you know, right. There's plenty in the notebook and something may well come out of it yet. But currently, they've not got my voice. They've not got the way I write. So I think that's good advice. Keep writing. Because it also takes a while to find the way you want to write, you know.
Absolutely.
Even within if you know within the definitions, whatever definition of haiku you're working with, and there are many, you still have to find the one that, you know, the way you want to write within your chosen discipline. And my particular discipline is the one where I'm not going to count syllables, because I think I've got to the stage where I sort of know in my gut where the limits are. But I do want, if I'm writing haiku as opposed to senryu, I do want a season in there, because I think the season helps with the emotion. It helps with the interpretation, because we generally all have a feeling about a season. If you can take your season and you can choose your words about the season, and the idea of the season, and it can help your reader. It gives your reader a huge clue as to the tone of your poem, and so many other things. It's just for me, the Kigo is essential, and maybe not a huge cut, but a bit of a cut. So, like I said to you before, I'm not hung up on a total phrase fragment thing, but I do want to hear a bit of a pause between ideas within the poem. So I wondered, when you're doing your kits, what advice are you giving, if any, on haiku form?
Well, on haiku form, in terms of just addressing the form itself, I point out that as it's practiced in English, which is the only thing I can speak to, but as it's practiced and published in English now, there are certain frameworks of how it's, you know, written down and cuts, and, you know, everything you speak of there. But there is not consensus across the board of all the different elements, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, the question of what is a haiku is not a question that you answer with words in a statement. It's what you discover for yourself as you write it and as you read it. And then, you know, the culture will take care of that. What survives for posterity, that's not, none of us have control over that. All we can do is do our best from our understanding, and then let things fall as they may. But I would like to speak to seasonality, because I think that's probably the one kind of concept where you and I maybe aren't necessarily on the same page. Because for me, yes, I believe seasonality is very important to haiku as a general thing, because it reflects what is very important in haiku, which is everything is transitional.
True.
The only total non-changing state is death. You know, if you're dead, nothing's going to change for you. If you're alive, everything's going to change for you, and there's no stopping that. Mm-hmm. Now, with seasonality, it can reflect on that transience of all things, which is very important to the spirit of haiku, I feel. However, I think, again, we get caught up with the concept of season. And so, for instance, leaves change color in the autumn. Do leaves change color because it's autumn? No. Leaves changing color is part of what is autumn. It is the manifestation of autumn. If we go back to, again, going out and having authentic experience and keeping to the moment, and that's very, of course, very important in haiku. It's of the moment. We write haiku in present tense because we're not writing about a past experience or a past event. We're writing out an experience that we had in the moment. So if you are true to what's going on around you, seasonality will come through what's naturally going on. And then seasonality becomes part and parcel to that authenticity of that experience, if it's part of that experience.
I think a key factor
for what I, and particularly when I talk about the foraging factor, because I think, again, the foraging factor is important because that's the tipping point. That's the point at which you can get out and get past your concepts and just focus on what is going on. If you go out and say, okay, it's autumn, I'm going to go write an autumn haiku. Well, you've already limited yourself and you're already focusing your mind in a way that might not capture what's actually out there. But if you just go out there and say, okay, I'm going to write about what's going on, if the autumn is manifesting in a way that's meaningful to you at that moment, it will come through. You don't have to force it. And, you know, certain haiku experiences aren't necessarily seasonally driven. Yes, the history and culture of haiku makes it very important, but at the same time, there are many haiku that are quite authentic and just as insightful for the experience that seasonality might be in the background, might not be really what's coming front and center. But if it's of the moment, then it's of the moment. And, you know, the world as it is right now, and the way we communicate, you know, the seasonality that comes out of Japanese haiku, well, Japan has a very particular climate. And so everybody experiencing haiku in Japan, and particularly back in the period where Japan was isolationist and of its own, they were, you know, when they say autumn, they knew what autumn felt like for where they were. And so do we. But if someone in Australia is reading, you know, a haiku I wrote, their experience of autumn might be different. And so if I just use autumn as a concept and put it out there, you know, winter day or something like that, that may or may not have resonance, you know. But again, if I'm capturing the manifestation of that autumn as it occurs, then it's going to have built-in authenticity because it's a real thing going on right now.
I think that's a better way to look at it, actually. Rather than forcing the issue on, you know, as you said, just writing about an autumn day, because you're not really offering anything to somebody who has no idea what an autumn day in Switzerland would look like. It's to be more authentic. I've got to give you something to hang on to rather than just give you an autumn day. It's meaningless. We recently spent a bit of time with Janice Doppler talking about Zocca.
Yes.
And I know you've been thinking a little bit about Zocca too. And I wondered, is this reflected in your work in Ghosts on Vacay?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tell us about it.
Well, this goes back to my original statement where I said there's something that's not a thing, but it's behind everything that is. Zocca is a good word for that. But it's not all inclusive. It's the great mystery, I think, and this is what drives me for haiku and really gets me excited when I'm, you know, dealing with haiku, because there's something goes on in the unfolding of the universe that we don't really understand. And then this is what as I said, we can't put it in a box. Okay. Consciousness, just if you strip everything away and just say, let's talk about consciousness, well, we don't know where consciousness comes from. We don't know even all its mechanics and how it works. We don't know why in a particular experience feels like a particular experience. I do a little bit of light science reading on the side as well. But when you start looking at everything humanity is looking at, from quantum physics all the way through, you know, psychology, philosophy, all of it, you know, there is natural law, universal law, something going on. Maybe it's God. I don't know. I don't know what's going on. But I know there's something there because I can experience it directly. I know that there is something about consciousness that makes an apple, this particular apple in my hand, have a feel, and it feels like something. But I don't know where that comes from. And maintaining that I don't know mind is very helpful for Aiko.
You met my husband at Haiku North America. It's a good job we didn't have this discussion with him. He's very much a physicist by education, although that doesn't preclude you from writing haiku, but he would have given us a hard time for that sort of statement. God love him.
I'll tell you another kind of hint at my mindset towards this. It came from quite a few years back. I was reading and talking with my wife about there was a man who I think it was upstate New York or maybe Maine, I can't remember exactly, but he disappeared into the woods and for like 20 years was living and did not see another human being. And he was surviving by robbing summer cabins and things like this. And he finally got caught and thrown in jail. But when and a writer went and talked to him about his experience, and he said that what out in the woods, totally by himself, what he learned was it was more important to have the experience than to attempt to understand the experience. And that really hooked me, you know? So there are concepts in Eastern thought of don't check yourself. Mm-hmm. Keep I don't know mind going and don't check yourself and just allow the natural processes, allow what you are to guide that. Because we have a brain, and that brain is designed to take in sensory input and to hold on to memory and thought and process. And it's observable. It's something you can observe. But once you start putting on belief and concept and all this, you tend to try to direct that instead of just experiencing it. Okay. So did that answer the question? I'm not sure.
I think so. The question is way back in my mind now because I'm thinking about so many other things as we go.
Well, you know, I think a lot of times questions are best left just as questions and the answer allowed to come whenever it comes.
As and when. Absolutely. Another question. Way back, I suppose, when you're thinking about the beat poets and how they've influenced the journey of haiku. Mm. I think it was probably fair to say around about that time and going maybe 10, 15 years after that, the idea of Zen and the influence of Zen was quite strong in haiku. Where are you on that scale? How does that influence you and how has that influenced what you've put together in your kits?
Kind of hoping this would come up, but I was ready for it.
Okay.
I've got a prepared statement for that.
Okay, right. Go for it.
All right. So we have Zen. Mm-hmm. Hmm? And we have haiku. Mm-hmm. So what can we say about them just as they are? both evolved in Japan during the same period of history. Both are concerned with experience just as it is, not as we conceive it to be, not as we want it to be, and not as we think it should be. Mm-hmm. And the practice of both calls for placing one's attention on the present moment and only the present moment. Now, both have now spread to cultures throughout the world and have undergone the translations and interpretations and everything else that inevitably brings. But long story short, I don't know, and I intend to keep not knowing.
Well, thank you for that.
I think it's the only answer that I wouldn't get hit by a Zen master for giving.
Okay, fair enough. The influence of Western education on the development of haiku. Would you care to say something about that?
Yes, it's an unfortunate thing. So there's a word that we don't use in haiku community, and it's appropriation. Mm-hmm. And it's a dangerous word, as you know. Mm-hmm. I think the difficulties that we have inherited because of how Western education works in general and how it's impacted haiku. You can get in this attitude of like, well, the pure haiku is a Japanese aesthetic haiku. That presupposes that you understand the culture that came from. Mm. And for most of us, we don't.
True.
And then also, there was a certain arrogance in how the Japanese culture was viewed and how haiku was brought in, that almost immediately it was, oh, well, here's an interesting poetry form the Japanese are doing. How do we westernize it? Mm-hmm. Or how do we interpret it through the Western lens? Yeah. Instead of letting it speak for itself. And so, you know, it's like looking at it from a Western lens, Western education tries to take everything and kind of distill it into little sound bites, right?
Yeah.
Little things. And so the idea that, like, even in that era, like, everybody had the same idea what haiku was, that these kind of conversations weren't going on when it was being written. Well, we know that's not true. I mean, we know Basho, you know, was a bit of a revolutionary and stepped away from being, you know, in the urban center and making his living out of judging other people's haiku and rewriting haiku. And he left all that and went and lived a simpler life so that he could follow the way of haiku the way he saw it. Yeah. And then, you know, the whole conversation that comes up around 575, because 575 haiku was used as a tool to teach children about syllables. And then the form becomes more important than the content. And it should never be that. You know, I want to address real quick after, I can't remember which podcast it was, but after a podcast that we had, there was the question of does form reduce creativity, or does you know the question I'm talking about. You'd send it out to the group.
Yeah.
And, you know, does an idea of form restrict your creativity? Gosh, I hope so. Because, you know, creativity is this rampant force that will just go out and do everything, you know. And yeah, for any person who's creative, who wants to end up with something that's consumable by someone else, that will actually make sense to somebody else, you have to limit your creativity. And that's part of what is the use and usefulness of the form, because it forces you to focus in instead of just doing whatever the hell you feel like, you know.
Yeah, that's something I'm tackling right at this moment. The first thing is looking at how haiku came to us and into the West, and as you say, we've never really addressed this sort of appropriation issue. Might have to look at that one.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's interesting that so often that you know, the station of the metro is held up as the first haiku written in English when, you know, a Japanese poet in San Francisco had written and published English haiku that he wrote before that was ever published. And quite frankly, it might have influenced Eliot.
Ezra Pound was quite influenced by French
pre-verse. Pound. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. I said Eliot.
That's okay. he was quite interested, and I don't know enough about Ezra Pound, the man. I suspect he was from a relatively wealthy family if he was toddling around Europe, talking to you know, staying in England, staying in France. So, yes, he spent a lot of time thinking and talking about free verse, and free verse came out, or rather his station in the Metro came had somewhat to do with free verse and his inkling of haiku. So I must go back and see how he put those two together, his knowledge of haiku. And anyway, as an editor, I can immediately spot the person who has not made the transition from Western poetry to a haiku frame, you know, frame of mind. What advice would you give to that poet, that one who's not made the switch yet?
My advice, first of all, would be to daily, let's put a number on it, daily read 5 haiku from various sources and write 1 haiku at least a day, and do that for, let's say, 100 days. Mm-hmm. That's a good start.
Yeah.
And then readdress the question. It goes back to what I just, you know, I said earlier. It's okay to leave a question as a question and then let the answer unfold.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you learn haiku by the experiencing of haiku. Now, and that's one thing, I guess, also is part of the DNA of Ghost on Vacay and on the field guide I'm working on. Mm-hmm. When I say haiku, what do I mean? Mm-hmm. And really, that's the whole complexity and difficulty of language, right? You know, there's a thing and I give it a name, and now I'm stuck with that name for that thing. Actually, kind of paraphrasing George Carlin here, but you know, I have a thought, I put a name, a word to it, and I'm stuck with that word for that thought. When I talk of haiku, yes, I mean the 3 lines, 1 line, 2 lines, whatever you get, you know, as a poem when you're done. But I'm also talking about the experience. You know, I often felt when I, you know, as I got into haiku more, that I've been experiencing haiku my whole life. Going out in the woods was a big thing, you know, and I experienced haiku my whole life. I only learned how to write it down after about 40 years of experiencing it. So, in fact, I want to share a little story on that, because I think it's kind of informative. Mm-hmm. When I was a child of about 7 or so, and we were on a visit to Warren, Pennsylvania, where my dad was from. And this was like about 3 years after his dad had died. Mm-hmm. And my dad was about 37 at the time. And he took me hiking. And this is, you know, my dad spent his youth rambling all over the mountains in this area. So he took me hiking and we were up the trail and we came to a place where a fallen log there. And he said, sometimes when you're in the woods, you need to just sit down and be quiet and see what happens. And so we sat down. And for a while, nothing happened. And, you know, as an adult looking back, I think he probably was thinking about his father and thinking about the loss of his father. Now he has his young son that he's trying to instill something in. And then we were sitting on a ridge with a little stream valley down below us. And on the opposite side of the ridge, a bear came walking out.
Oh.
And the bear didn't know we were there. The wind was blowing in our faces, so the bear had no idea. And suddenly, everything went away. The only, you know, my experience, everything went away. The only thing that mattered was that bear. And seeing what that bear was doing in its natural environment without any awareness that we were around. That was the start for me. That was the very beginning of this journey, that the bear itself has its reality and its meaning, and it is as part of the life that's unfolding as I am, or I am as part of, as much a part of the life unfolding here as it is. And at the core of my identity is nature. And that's something we haven't talked about yet, is nature. You know, when you say a haiku is a nature poem, right? Well, what do you mean? And what is nature? And that's something I've worked with, whether I've been painting, writing, acting. What is nature? You know, and you know, a puddle in your backyard is as natural as the ocean. And a weed growing in your flower bed is nature manifesting itself. Mm-hmm. And your observation of something going on is nature too. We can't escape. Again, philosophy, right? But I feel we cannot escape from the fact that we came from the exact processes that bear came from, or the exact process that this rock came from. We're all atoms. We're all energy. And what we are always changes. Even our physicality. Every atom I have in my body is not the same atom that little boy had. It's all different. And, you know, I spent a lot of my life moving around. Up until we moved here to Wilmington, I had never lived in any one place for any one home or in even regions for more than, say, 3-4 years. I've been here now for going on 12 years. And I am very much of this place now, both reality-wise, because I have all the atoms I have been drawn from all the atoms that are around here. And the air I breathe is the same air that's informing everything that's going on around me. So now I feel I'm grounded in the reality of my environment here, and it allows me to explore it with freedom.
We should wrap up shortly, because I thought that your story was a great place to stop, but now you've moved on, and I'm going to tackle you on one more thing before we sure. Sort of head to the end. You talk about nature, and you've opened up a whole thing that we cannot do today because we would be here for hours.
Understood.
Is haiku a nature poem, or is it not? And I think this ties back to what you were talking about when we touched on seasonality. You talked about seasonality being transience, and maybe haiku is really all about, and maybe this is why I love the idea of this, the season and the seasonality in the haiku. Maybe haiku is actually about transience. And that might, because we have in the past, we have tried to tackle where does humanity come into the haiku and writing about urban life and humans, where does that come within the form? And maybe that solves that particular issue. If we think about haiku as being about transience, we're transient. Our lives are transient. Our thoughts, our processes, you know, my hair color, it's all transient. You know, it's maybe that's how we look at it. But we'll have to come back and discuss that another day, I think. So, Craig, I think you've answered my questions solidly. We've spoken about ghosts on vacay, but have we missed anything that is particularly important to you about ghosts on vacay?
Just a couple of things. The website of Ghosts on Vacay, as I said, it has 3 haiku creation kits on there right now that you can download as a PDF and try. It also has some blog entries that, you know, deal with this exploration, but everything I'm doing and the book that I'm pulling together is very, very focused on taking what, again, is going on with me day by day and and using that as the source for what's going into the field guide. I guess the thing to realize is I am not dealing in these things with the history of haiku. I'm not dealing with, you know, broad philosophical ideas about haiku. There is plenty, you know, I point people to the Haiku Foundation. I point people to this podcast. I point people to where, with our totally interconnected age, there is everything you ever want to read about. But again, I'm just set that aside for now and just go out and experience it. And that's kind of what I'm doing. And something I hope to add also this year, before the end of the year, is a little audio journal that I'm going to do on a irregular basis that will be called Basho Heard a Frog, which relates back to the stickers I had for the conference. But it is going to be focused on the sound of haiku pretty much solely. So the idea that haiku itself has some musicality to it and some rhythm to it. And obviously the choice of a line break, or do I use punctuation or not? All that stuff impacts how those words flow. And sometimes I think it's something we don't necessarily pay enough attention to. I'll be reaching out to other haiku poets with, you know, something I feel is particularly interesting in the way that they've sounded out their haiku, and we'll explore that just from the sound factor of it. So I'm kind of looking forward to that side of it too.
Before we finish, you mentioned your little stickers you had at the conference.
Yes.
But maybe you should tell us a little bit about the artwork that goes with Ghosts on Vacay.
Yeah, so can we see that?
Yes.
Is that reversed?
No, it says, Basho heard a frog and made of his mind a pond.
Yes. So this was, you know, when you go to a haiku conference, you have to have things to give out and share with people. So this was a sticker I made for the conference. It's a simple line drawing that I did of the frog. And this referred back to something it was actually a little video by a Japanese educator about the writing of the old pond. We actually have a record of how that haiku was written. One of his Basho's students was present when it was written, and he wrote out how that experience laid down. And the point with that, and it's a very interesting one, is that when Basho wrote the old pond, he was not standing in front of an old pond. He was sitting with his students and they heard the frogs, and the old pond existed in his head. Mm-hmm. And really is there as a metaphor of the mind in some ways. So that what the sound of water was what brought the frog into his mind. And so the old pond becomes the mind, and the sound of the frog becomes what brings the frog into that mind. That's one interpretation of it anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very much a Basho devotee, but I also, you know, embrace Santoka and other later masters, and I love Issa. But the thing about Basho is his constant pointing out to go out and get your own experience. Mm. You know, don't emulate me. Don't emulate me. Go out and get your own experience. And that's the message I receive from Basho.
Hence Ghost on Vacay and the process that you go through.
Yes.
Well, Craig, that's probably a good place definitely to stop, and just remind people to go to the show notes, get hold of your website there, and go and get the freebies. Go and get the freebies, because they're going to help you to write better haiku.
And I wish everybody wonderful experiences and meaningful experiences.
And I'm guessing that you'd like some feedback too, when people have used your sheets.
Always helpful to get feedback on it. You know, all these haiku kits have been extensively field tested by me, but I would love to hear other people's experiences with it. Yeah, every kit that I've done is experience that I've worked through myself, and again, so that you can have some experience without having to worry about filtering your brain out too much.
Well, if I ever get that Apple haiku that I feel is publishable, I shall send it to you first, Craig. And
Oh, I appreciate that. I'd love to see
don't sort of hang about waiting on it though, because it's my
it.
current
Things
efforts
take
on
as long
that.
as they take.
This is very true. So, Craig, thank you very much. It was definitely worth the wait. Well, for me anyway, it was definitely
Oh,
worth the
very, very
wait.
much for me too. Thank you.
Okay. And I think people will enjoy the kits, so I encourage them to go to the website, have a look at ours, get the website details, go and visit Craig and let him know what you think. And perhaps send him the odd poem to let him know that you've used his kit too. Thank you, Craig.
You're welcome.
Wow. I loved chatting to Craig. He's given me so much to think about. And of course, I still have to create that Apple haiku. At least one I'm happy with. Do go over to his website. Check out the resources there. Link, as I so often say, in the show notes. I wanted to remind you, as Craig and I touched on it in our conversation, that this year on Poetry P, we'll be looking at how haiku came to the West from a bilingual perspective. In episodes 4 and 5 of this 7th series, we looked at haiku from the German language. Obviously, the podcasts are mostly in the English language, don't worry. We'll continue this theme and weave it into the episodes this year. We'll be looking at how haiku developed in many Western languages, including, of course, my own English. Now, Craig mentioned a haiku written by a Japanese chap, which purports to be the first haiku written in English. It's by Yone Noguchi, and it appears in his novel, The American Diary of a Japanese Girl, which was published in 1902. It was a novel written in the guise of an autobiography. The haiku, in case you're interested, was this. Remain, oh remain, my grief of sayonara, there in the water sound. Remain, oh remain, my grief of sayonara, there in the water sound. Now, I can't dispute whether this was the first one or not. I haven't done the research. But if anyone would like to disagree, please do. But send me the evidence. Well, thanks again to Craig for spending time with us today. And thank you for joining me and watching or listening. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, please do give a review to the podcast wherever you get yours, or you can comment on YouTube. And if you'd be so kind, spread the word via your social media. And maybe you could sponsor us with a membership or a coffee. I would be eternally grateful for all or any of the above. And one last reminder to check out the submission diary. So until next time, keep writing. And of course, there are lots of bits and bobs in the show notes this time. If I've forgotten anything, you know the score, email me. Ciao.